So hi, I'm Anand Deshpande. I'm the founder of Persistent Systems Limited, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Yeah. My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a conversation with the founder, chairman, and managing director of Persistent Systems, Anand Deshpande. Stay tuned. You know, I can't repeat it enough, but I'm so grateful to you for listening and subscribing to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, and for sharing it with your friends and family. And of course, if you're enjoying them, please feel free to rate and write a review. So we sometimes find ourselves in the presence of people who are simply humble titans. They may not be the loudest or flashiest in a crowd, but their incredible actions, capacity for growth, and impeccable vision all magnetically draw others to their inspiring well of leadership. And so this is most definitely how I felt when sharing a conversation with Anand Deshpande, the founder, chairman, and managing director of the tech company Persistent Systems. Anand grew up in Bhopal and now lives in Pune in Maharashtra. He graduated from IIT and then, like a lot of his classmates, came to the US to study and completed his master's and PhD in computer science at Indiana University. After spending some time in Silicon Valley at Hewlett-Packard, he decided to actually return to India, where he founded Persistent Systems in 1990 and served as CEO as it grew to a multinational publicly traded company with digital engineering and enterprise modernization solutions for all sectors. By the way, just to give you some scale of this journey, when Anand started Persistent, the IT export business from India was less than $50 million. Today, it's around $250 billion, so it's fairly safe to say that Anand has been part of a transformative revolution with global impact. His skills as a servant leader helped his company to scale through many successes and challenges and navigate thoughtfully through its natural orbital leaps with humility, innovation, and execution. Anand stepped away from his CEO role a few years ago and now has been using his immense knowledge, energy, and network expertise to help build and elevate ecosystems in an evolving India, whether in the biotech sector understanding cancer genomics, or for the millions of nano entrepreneurs out there, or for helping founders scale beyond that first plateau of achievement into a second orbit of growth. His broad portfolio of nonprofit and philanthropic work also magnify his superb commitment to giving, constantly uplifting others, and learning through collaboration. So I was truly grateful to catch up with him for a conversation about everything from creating jobs to the identity formation of today's Indian entrepreneurs. But I was first curious to know what he was currently learning and if he was comfortable being a novice with a new skill.
Yes, I think it's a very good question. And the last few years, I've been thinking a lot about the importance of continuous learning. And I've been trying to figure out the process of why I learn and how I learn. Okay, so I'll tell you what I'm found myself trying to figure out at the moment. And that's some areas of biotechnology. What happened is that for the last several years, I've been working with medical doctors, some of them, around trying to build data sets for Indian populations. Being a computer science data guy, that's an area that I understand. And we realized that whether you take cancer or diabetes or any of these things, we are treating Indians on the basis of data that is coming from international data sets. And it's time we need to change that. So I got involved in it. And for the last few years, I've been working with some of those people. You know, as you look at the problem, it's a more complicated problem than I thought, just not about collecting data. There's a motivation. Why should doctors and clinicians give data and share data and all of those kinds of things. And the government started to become an important part of where this needs to go. So most recently, the Department of Biotechnology in the government of India reconstituted their research labs. They have about 14 of them all across India. And they merged them into something called BRIC, such as the Biotechnology Research and Innovation Council. And the secretary who I was pushing, saying, hey, let's do something, kind of sucked me in and said, hey, can you help me be the co-chair of this DBT BRIC setup? So now I'm firmly in this sort of biotechnology area, and I know nothing about it. So
well, and by the way, does that feel uncomfortable? Does it feel comfortably uncomfortable to be a novice?
No, I'm quite comfortable with the fact that I don't know anything. So I'm not going in with the fact that, oh, I know everything, or I'm going to swing my way through, bullshit my way through. So I'm talking to all these biologists who know I know nothing. Okay, but I know enough to ask the right questions and learn on the process. So I've been, again, my daughter is actually a PhD in synthetic biology. So she has been feeding me stuff as well. So I've been spending time trying to learn. I don't expect to become an expert at biotechnology. That's not my intention. But I have been given a 3-point charter by the secretary to work on this BRIC thing, and I'll share that charter. And to that extent, I'm trying to fill in my understanding. And it takes a while for me to learn new things, but I will share with you how I do it. It's very satisfying when you figure things out. So my charter with BRIC is, one, is to help create a new PhD program. And what I'm trying to tell BRIC PhD program, again, I'm just a contributor, okay? They are really going to do it. Yeah. I'm the one who's trying to disrupt them. So I told them that you should not focus on PhD as the degree, but you should think about creating a cohort of researchers who are going to be researchers for 40 years. So think about 40-year journey. Don't think about the artifact of the dissertation. Second, I'm trying to tell them this, that what you know is important, but who you know is even more important. And who knows you is even more important. So think about the PhD program as a place where the cohort of 75 students that we are going to take should know each other and should know as many people as possible, not just things. So that, you know, when they get to their 40-year career, 10 years out, 5 years out, when they need to do something different, they know who to call. And let the people know that these people are the people who are doing good stuff, so that, you know, they get pulled up to nicer activities and projects. So make sure they're exposed to different things. Second charter they have asked me to do is to bring computer science faculty, mainly IITs and other places, to biology and see who of those faculty members may be interested in working in these bio labs, and see if I can bring them together to work that out. So I'm trying to organize an event in May around the funding cycle, to see if the funding can be sort of jointly funding between two institutions, or influence funding, because at the end of it, motivation has to come from somewhere. And the last thing I'm trying to figure out is, what is holding these ideas that people have within these research labs from going into the market? Mm-hmm. We have a lot of researchers. Everyone does their own things. The incentives are for researchers are to publish papers, have PhD students and postdocs. But there's no collaboration, and translation is not really high priority. So how do we help some of these individuals to think big differently? And how do you bring entrepreneurs to this game and all? So my charter is not biology, really. But for me to be in a conversation with these people, when they say something, I should know what they're saying. So that is my context. And the other thing is, you know, one other important thing that I'm supposed to do as part of all this stuff is to help them find money. Everything in India is all about money. Well, not just India, everywhere else in the world, it's about getting the right money to the right things. So I've been trying to talk to investors as to why bio and biotechnology is so exciting. We're going to have to make that excitement happen if people are going to fund this. And I really believe that, you know, next of what I saw in the software industry in 1990 when I came back to India, I think a similar opportunity next 20 years is going to be in biotechnology, because everything, food, water, energy, everything is going to get affected by bio. And if we don't do our own R&D and research and play our own role in it, somebody else is going to define it for us. So I think we really need to invest in this. And that's what I've been working on.
Is this same idea of taking the playbook that you learn in the software industry, that you grew as a leader in a separate universe, is applying that blueprint, applying that playbook now to a brand new area and something that you are a novice in? Is that in a way really the secret to vibrancy and longevity as a leader, especially in a place like India where it is rapidly evolving all the time?
See, the reality is that, you know, when I came back to India in 1990, the Indian software industry was about $30 million. And we had no idea what India and software could be. None of us knew it. And there are many decisions that got made in the early 90s that have helped India become a software powerhouse. It's $310 billion industry last year. So from 30 million to 310 billion in about 32, 33 years is how I've seen it. And it's staggering, and not just the numbers, the growth as such, but what has been very, very phenomenal in many ways is the fact that Software today contributes a big part of the economy, in both in terms of exports, in terms of GDP, and all the other things as well. And also created an opportunity for a large number of employment at the higher levels, creating multiple tertiary, secondary, and tertiary jobs. I think a similar movement in bio is also possible if certain decisions are made. And then I think in India, there are many aspects of this decision. One is, of course, creating the staff, people, manpower, whatever you might call it, technique, well-trained technologists or somewhere people who understand these newer things with a clear understanding of where they are going to go. That is a big part of what happened in the software industry. Meaning, there's no shortage of, every college, every corner has a computer science degree right now in India. So the number of people that has just made it possible that, you know, there's enough good people in the whole network and everyone is sort of excited about software. Biology doesn't have that level of training in the country. We don't have the research. The ecosystem is not tied up. Also, you know, if you have to do a biomanufacturing plant or anything like that, the gestation period, the regulation, all of those things are not well thought of. So there are gaps in the whole ecosystem. And I can see the differences in terms of running a software business as compared to running these businesses. They are inherently different, but the government and policies can really help in making sure that we can move much faster than we are moving today.
Right. And by the way, that has that injected perhaps a new sense of urgency or vibrancy for you as a leader?
Yes, in a sense. See, I'm new into this. Okay, so I got this particular role about 4 months back. Okay, and it's not something new for the government or anybody else who is there. They are all in it for 40 years, 50 years, 30 years, whatever. These labs have been around for a long time. They're doing what they're doing. I'm just observing from a distance and trying to see how I see the gaps in some sense. And I'm trying to see if I can share those with people and influence them to take a look at these. I'm not necessarily sure that this might necessarily change anything from their point of view. But what I believe is that if I can bring external agencies, mainly funding, right? So if I can get the VCs to think about how to think about this industry, and I know some of them have been part of, I wouldn't say I'm part of it, but I'm an LP in many of these funds. So I know those guys well.
Yeah.
I know what they're looking for. I think I can connect the dots. That's been my strength in a way, is to be able to network people between different things. And I believe I do keyword intersections quite well. So if somebody says something and somebody else says something, I know how to connect them. And I spend almost 20% of my time just forwarding mails, actually.
You mentioned that there's a, you know, this is a long game, right? It's a longitudinal process. And, you know, even part of your charter to really think about the PhD process, which in some ways itself is long, but thinking about it much more long-term than just the commodity and the transaction of obtaining a degree, but rather what's really the long game for this. In an era where instant gratification and AI solutions that are giving, that are building things for institutions or enterprises or individuals, they seem like the expectations are instantaneous. And so for you, what do you find motivating and in some ways kind of help mirror about longitudinal learning and particularly about longitudinal patience?
See, if you think about the kids or the people I deal with in the younger generation, the guys who are in their 20s, college students and these PhD students and all that, they're all born after 2000. And most of them, well, a good number of them will see 2100. Hmm. And they're going to work till 2085.
Right? Yeah.
So another 60 years. And we don't know what's going to happen 5 years from now.
Right.
So the reality is that if you have to survive this 40, 50 years of work that these kids are going to have to deal with, the only way they can survive is if they can adapt to what might come when it comes. So if I have to be there at the time when it happens, then I need to have the tools that I need to have so that I can evolve myself. And there are two sets of tools, I think, that are going to become very important. One is what you do for yourself. And second is, who else can you tap for pushing yourselves ahead in some sense? Because, you know, you'll never know everything yourself, and the complexity of what is happening in the world, and you pointed to that, is such that we are seeing way too much is happening. So if all of these things are going to happen, then I need to know, I need to stay up to understand enough about what I should ask and I should have at least, I could ask ChatGPT the question, but I should at least know what to ask. So I need to know enough to be able to do that. And then who else I know, who else can I argue with and provoke myself or provoke the other people to say, hey, can we together find the questions that we need to ask? Maybe the answers already exist, but somebody has to find the question.
Yeah.
So
if what you're saying is for that patience and that longitudinal nimbleness to weather any kind of situation in the future, that being unknown and ambiguous, is to know as an individual how to ask the right questions and to also know the people that are involved in making sure that you have good collaborators and good people to bounce ideas off of. In the same way, in reflecting back on when you first started Persistent and till the situations that you're thinking right now, if those two are the accelerators to weathering change, are the threats to success in an ecosystem, whether it's software or biotech or finance, or are the threats still the same as they were when you first started, or have they evolved also?
Yeah. So as I said, you know, learning to learn and learning to network are the two accelerators. So well, how well you can figure things out and how well you can network are definitely the things. In the beginning, when we started, the threats were mainly self-inflicted government of India kind of issues, the regulations and everything else, getting funding and all those kinds of things. And the whole ecosystem and the lack of infrastructure was the biggest threat. I think today those threats are not that much of a threat. People are more willing to fund startups, to fund new ideas and all of those kinds of things. I think so I think threats have also changed a little bit. Things have become far more competitive, for sure. A lot of people are trying many things. So if you're running a business, you can't assume that you have a full runway to do whatever for several years. But there are many people who are trying many things. It's good. It's very competitive right now. So from an individual or a company standpoint, the threats are a little different from the sense that they're more competitive. They're more to do with product trends, technology trends, geopolitical, all these other things, which you may or may not control. But the name of the game is to navigate these threats. Threats are going to always be there. Yeah. And the way to navigate them is to figure things out in the agility that we talked about. And the second is by taking help, meaning you cannot do everything on your own. So you should be able to ask the right people and maybe collaborate, cooperate, whatever it takes, ask questions, mentors. All of these things have become very essential because you just can't figure out everything yourself. And being you know, having that humility that, hey man, I don't know all these things, but I can ask someone to help me, really makes a difference.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with the founder of Persistent Systems, Anand Deshpande. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, this is Vidya Balan, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, guys. I'm Indra Nui.
Hi, I'm Prakash Janakaraman.
And this is Mahesh Kare, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Anand Deshpande.
You know, there's a lot of motivation that's required to push yourself, whether you're an artist, whether you're a business leader. And when we were talking earlier, and even in the things that you're mentioning right now, I can hear a lot of pride in your voice about all the activities, you know, as a Puneri, as an Indian, and yet your time abroad in the US was perhaps essential to, you know, just jumpstarting some of the success and achievement of the company and yourself. So how do you reflect on the fuel for some of this success in a way coming from your individual motivation and achievements in an external environment?
Well, I would agree that my US stint was very essential for both Persistent and for my personal thing. I spent about 5 years approximately in Indiana University Bloomington, where I was a PhD student. And there, you know, being a PhD student in a liberal arts college is actually a lot of fun and good learning. And I spent about 18 months in the Bay Area at Hewlett-Packard Laboratories in Palo Alto. And we were right across from Stanford and all of the other things. And I had a lot of time, both of these places. The thing was the intensity of just busy, being busy was not that busy. So I had enough time to float around, do a lot of interesting things, meet a lot of people and all. So I really benefited from that. US has always been a market for persistent. So for the last 30 plus years, we have been selling in the US, and I've been traveling to the US roughly every 6 weeks for a couple of weeks, except for the last 3 to 4 years now that I'm not CEO. I do less.
Yeah.
But see, US has always been a benchmark for everything that we have done there. So if you look at it from the India point of view, whether you take education, college, students, quality of faculty, everything that we did at Indiana was a shade better than where I was coming from. And I was at IIT. So it was not like they were bad, but the kind of exposure one could see, the way degrees and life was approached as a student in a large liberal arts college was very different and very, very encouraging and very enriching in many ways. I was not, IIT, we were regimented much more than, it was more the assignment and the test and everything else. Here it was far more open-ended. It got me a chance to think very differently. My life at HP was one of the best companies to work at that point. And we had Bill and Dave still around, and we were in the lab, which was where their offices used to be. And HP was the benchmark for a company that you could think about in the early 90s, 89, 90. And Bay Area at that point, and even today, continues to be the hotbed of innovation and excitement and everything else. So, you know, sitting from India, we were always looking and say, hey, you know, our benchmarks were not necessarily Indian companies, but say, how can we look at US companies and see how do they do them better, and why are they so much better? And can we not put ourselves into a situation where we can see the goals and the objectives to be saying, hey, those guys do it, what is holding us back, right? So yes, there has been the pride that, yeah, I'm doing it from India. I'm doing it because I want to do it from India, not because I had to. I could have stayed in the US and stayed there, but I always wanted to be in India. And it's a fact, you know, it's in our country, we can make something happen. You have the canvas sort of is more blank for us here. You know, you can paint whatever you want.
Yeah.
So that sense, it was very good. And being in India, being doing it from Pune, Marathi heartland, all that stuff. It's all those good stuff that happened. While that was going on, the benchmark was always the US and the Bay Area and Boston or whatever else you might pick up. So talking to companies, talking to people who are really cutting edge or, you know, pushing the frontier in business or anything else, and the opportunity to meet them and learn from them, really pushed me and the business. Everything else I've done and I've talked about has been strongly, strongly influenced by my network in the US.
Yeah. In that same way, and you talked a little bit earlier about perhaps the differences and the switch that turned both on and off when you stopped being CEO. And when you stepped away from being CEO at Persistent, I'm curious for you what elements were actually liberated, not just for you, but also for the company.
Actually, the company has done very well after I moved on. Okay. So that's a good thing to note.
Yeah. somewhat reassuring, right?
That is very reassuring. But I'm going to go through 3 steps of how this happened. So I'm going to share one story, which was the early one. It's from 97, 98. So before that, you know, it was my company. So I'm doing this because I want to do it. In 97, 98, we flipped from being my company to our company. Okay. It's a huge transition. It took me 1 year to make that transition. Because the question was, who's this company for? Who are you making decisions for? When I changed my thinking, saying this is not my company, it's our company, I got to the point that I'm the CEO of the company. And my aspirations are what I want to do, but I must not come in the way of the company's aspiration. And having run the business for 30 years, I could see myself doing it for another few more years, but I could not see myself doing this for the next 30 years. And there were many things that I wanted to do, which I could not pursue because my priority as the CEO of the company meant that I should focus my time and energy on doing what is right for the company and make sure that, you know, every quarter grind happens, the rhythm is a quarter rhythm. I just sort of felt that, you know, having done this for 30 years, there was just this feeling that, you know, I'm going to turn 60 next year. Let me just kind of find a way to make sure that I'm not full on in the business, but I have other things that I can look at which have more longer term ideas. And I should find somebody else who can run it as well, help him with whatever. I still continue to be chairman and I continue to own sizable stake in the company, which I have had from the beginning. So I am not completely out of the company. All the same, I am spending very little time on the operations of the company. But that transition was tough, but I thought it was essential and necessary. And this is another thing that I've been talking about a lot, is that, you know, businesses go through a sequence of S-curves. So you do certain things, you see a growth, and you flatten out, and the next, and the next, and the next. And every transition requires very different kinds of things. So we had reached that point where, you know, if the company had to transition to the next level, it had to move off being a founder-driven company to a more CEO-led and board-led companies in some sense, and move on to that level. So, you know, then the company has its own life and it can stay on to being, you know, CEO to CEO, whatever else is the board's decision. And it's not just me, because I'm the founder, deciding what needs to happen. So that transition was necessary for the company, and it was helpful for me because, you know, I just felt that, you know, I could contribute so much more to other things, and that transition was very valuable. It was not easy, I must say that. Okay, you know, when you are in the kitchen, it's very exciting.
Right.
A lot of things going on. You get the action, you have the power. You can say, go do this, go do that. And you sort of walk out of the kitchen. You say, hey, what the hell am I going to do? Do I have another kitchen to work in? So it's always tough. It took me about. But you know, I had enough things going on. So I just decided that I need to move on. COVID helped. Nobody was traveling, and I could sort of shut down on some of these things. And I'm quite happy right now.
You know, for those people who have a difficult time with that, you know, they making those transitions, whether it's transiting from one position to another or from a role like yours where it's a kind of benevolent dictatorship to a much, much more broad-based, democratized power structure, those who may not succeed at first, what are oftentimes the pitfalls? Like, you know, easily this transition that you mentioned, it took a long time. It was not the easiest transition. I'm imagining that there were several things that could have gone wrong, but they didn't, right? And would you say that there were some specific lessons that were learned from that transition that, you know, others who you maybe be colleague, they might be colleagues who've gone through this, or people in the future go through this? Like, there are some one or two takeaways that specifically you were very much surprised by.
I wouldn't say I was surprised. I was told, warned about all these things, but it's still hard to do them. But I'll tell you the reality of what really is important if you want to make this transition. So one is, you have to admit and accept that when somebody else comes in, he's going to run it differently from yours. Yeah. Not necessarily wrong, but it's different. Second thing you have to accept and understand is that the internal politics in the company actually will come. People will come and tell you that, oh, this guy's doing something, this, that. Trying to push you to act against something. This is sort of it. So first thing I did was I cut off all these guys. I stopped meeting everyone.
Right.
I said, man, your problem, you deal with your boss. I'm supporting him full on, and I'm not getting involved in all this internal politics. If you want to say something, go tell him directly. Yeah. Don't tell me. I'm not a conduit for your sob story.
You can't be the third party Kaka or Azoba who's dealing with this kind of stuff.
It just becomes a mess, right? Meaning you can see that. Third thing you have to do is, you have to have enough things that you can do on your own. That's your problem. Otherwise, what happens is, if you don't have anything else going on, then you say, you are always tempted to say, here, let me go see what is going on. Let me go see, attend your meetings, okay? Why don't I just sit in and listen to it? I will coach the people in the company, all this stuff, right? Coach people in the company, meaning what? Meaning then you are sitting around listening to people and then trying to, you are getting sort of tempted to act and you don't know whether you should act or not. So it's very crazy. So if I have enough other things going on, then I'm less, I don't have time to do this right now. So if somebody says, okay, can you do this for me at Persistent? I don't have time for you. Sorry, I have other things going on.
Right.
So that just made it
easier. Almost like you have to set boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You have to give time, man. These things just don't happen overnight. People take time. Yeah. You guys come in, they take time. People complain that, oh, company is different. It doesn't feel the same. It's doing this and that. Yeah, that's by design, right? Everyone is going to run it differently.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, we'll come back to our conversation with Anand Deshpande. Stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. This is Sid Sriram, and you're now listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, this is Farhan Akhtar.
Hi, guys. I'm Ananya Pandey.
Hi, this is Madhuri Dixit, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Welcome back to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with the founder of Persistent Systems, Anand Deshpande.
You mentioned that you had many, many interests and many, many things planned. That was part of kind of the success of making that transition. And in thinking about all the things that you do in your portfolio of work, I imagine that there is a thrill and an excitement of giving and sharing and helping others grow and evolve, especially in this new Indian landscape of entrepreneurs. But again, particularly at the nano-entrepreneurial side, how can the success and wealth of a growing ecosystem be more equitably distributed, particularly at scale? And so is the measure of that success in mentoring and developing, does that mean that there by default have to be fewer giants and rather a forest of just healthy, robust trees?
Actually, that's the reality today. Let me share a little context for you in terms of what we are doing in the India context as well. So if you think about India right now, there are 63 million small businesses or businesses registered in India. 95% of them are small businesses. 95% of those small businesses are sub 1 crore businesses. Okay, 70% of all people employed in India in the non-farm, any of these jobs situation, are employed with small businesses. So small businesses are really what dominate the country. Unfortunately, from the top-down point of view from the government, they go to the big companies. When people talk about skill development, they say jobs and all that. They see the large numbers that they think are large in the large companies, but they are actually very small compared to the whole ecosystem and also are dwindling. More and more automation is going to make sure that the larger companies will have fewer people for, you know, say dollar generated or any economical millions of dollars generated per employee is going to go up by definition, by fact, and especially in the larger companies. So jobs are going to happen in the small businesses. This is the reality. Unfortunately, I was surprised that this is not as well accepted as it should be, but this is the reality. The second thing is, if you look at the demographics in India, we have 1.4 billion people. Half of them are below the age of 30, 35. However you look at it, any number you look at, every age we have more than 25 million people. 25 million 18-year-olds, 25 million 19-year-olds. You can cut it any which way, but we need about 18 million jobs every year. Most of those jobs are not going to happen in large companies. They're going to happen because of self-employment and job creators at scale. If you look at all the unrest in India, a lot of the unrest in India is going to happen through jobs. Lack of jobs is the number one problem that we have. And when you talk about jobs, there are two parts to the jobs, the quantity and the quality of jobs. The quality of jobs is equally important. So you want people to be making, in the urban setting, at least 25,000 rupees a month. Now, this is might seem like a pretty small number in some sense, but if you look at the statistics, half the people in India don't make anywhere near this. Okay, meaning the average 10,000 rupees is one bar that people talk about, is sort of the employment low end, whatever you think about, it's in that range. And it's very hard to be in a good long-term situation with that kind of money. Because, you know, one injury, one somebody's sick, one wedding, you're in debt and you're gone for life. When you get past 25,000 rupees a month, you start to feel like you can make savings. You can have a scooter, you have money for your kids' education, you have health insurance, you have just have that whole ecosystem starts working in your favor. And within 10, 15 years, you are sort of off, dependent on these. You have savings, you have insurance, you have all the necessary things that you would need to get you past that, that small things are not going to kind of ruin you. So this is very important.
Sure.
So that's sort of where we are, we've been focusing on as the ASRA Foundation. So in the foundation, yeah. I'm very much focused on nano entrepreneurs. We call them nano because we work with them up to 1 crore is what we think is a really small one. Not necessarily that they're the only ones to help, but you know, it's good to have a focus. You should have a target market. The kinds of issues that 1 crore business or 50 lakh business have are very different from a 5 crore or 20 crore business. And we just stay focused on that. And we're trying to find what do it take to make sure these small photographers, beauty salons, tailors, dance class, this class, that class, food counters, food businesses, lots of them all across. And how do they make sure that they do not fail and they can be successful and keep growing on an ongoing basis? So that's really what we've been working on. And we are about 250,000, 270,000 businesses in the network. We've been doing it for about 10 years. I started this in 2013. While I was still full-time at Persistent, I got permission from the company saying that I'm going to use my money to do some of this thing. I've crossed 50 and I need to think about some of these things. So that's how we got started. And after I moved on, I've been thinking more on these topics. And I got another one that I picked up, which we call Second Orbit, where we take 25 crore companies or 20 crore companies and see how to take them to 200 crores. So two different segments. One is the 0 to 1 small, tiny nano businesses. And the other one is how do you scale people from the first orbit to the second orbit?
You know, even with that, have you found that the trends with institutions and with policies to make sure that access to credit and networks, you know, more and more available, like you mentioned, the scale of this is impossible to comprehend, which means that the amount of capital that's probably required to lift this entire group up must just be enormous. And so has it been also challenging to convince peers and partners and government-based stakeholders that this work is just as equally as important as accelerating established businesses that, as you said, are in fact not necessarily at the heart of where India's success, you know, might lie in the future?
So there are people and government has many schemes for many of these kinds of things. So everybody understands the importance of this. This is a large community. They're the real voters in this country. So anything that delivers votes is going to be important. So having said that, the reality is that while the government has many schemes and many programs and all that, banks have many programs. The process, and this is legacy of our thing, so paperwork, the process of how to get from, so the government may have a scheme that I'm going to give you loans and this, but to get that loan, they'll say, I need to have collateral, I need this. If I'm a photographer, I don't have collateral, I don't have this. So there's so many reasons why I cannot access and avail the schemes that are available from the government. That is where we are spending a lot of time trying to say, okay, how do you help from the business side get the schemes so you get access to the money, access to various things. And also from the government side, help them to say, hey, no, can maybe don't have such unrealistic expectations because this is not what the reality is. So trying to see how to bridge those two things. And it's a gradual, but it's happening. People are understanding the importance of this group for sure. I can say that with some confidence. And, you know, there are some new digital schemes that have come up. Of course, you know, there's a whole lot of India Digital Stack that is happening, right? So one of the two programs that I think I'm quite optimistic, they're still long way away. But one of them is the Account Aggregator Program. And so the idea here is to do flow-based lending. So essentially, if I can show you my cash flow, what I'm making every day, every month, then I know approximately how much I can do. So I can calculate on the basis of my cash flows. And that gives me ability to get some working credit. And that could be transformational. So how do I make that happen? And we are working. The government has schemes. They're trying this out. But again, you know, all these things work well when you have enough people who are on it. And the second new thing that people have been working on along with Nandan mainly driving it called ONDC. So ONDC, the idea is to build an API where people who have products, especially small businesses, I have my Lonchi Papad or whatever else. How do I push an API so that if somebody is looking for Lonchi Papad, they should be able to search the network and find me as the person who has the Papad that you might need? So there's an API that's getting built out, and it's encouraging people to standardize on how you would put your catalogs online and how your pricing would be online and how you can negotiate a trade in some sense to happen online. There's a lot of movement going on how do you get digital rails to happen in India. Again, it'll take time, but there is a lot of discussion about how to make this seamless at scale.
And I just had a thought that popped up in that, you know, you talk about these digital solutions for matching cash flow with lenders and assessing risk, and at the same time, you know, matching products with potential stakeholders who can therefore invest in those products. And I'm thinking about, of course, with digital transformation, especially in the world of AI, that, you know, these are solutions that potentially have great transformation where AI is involved. Yep. And yet, if I'm not mistaken, AI would never be able to replace the kind of people mentorship that's required to, in fact, make these solutions possible. So do you imagine a day where software and AI actually replace the kind of accelerators that mentorship offers?
Yeah, I think, you know, you will see AI augmented mentorship happening for sure. Yeah, meaning I think these things are pretty good, right, these days, meaning if, and very often, unfortunately, or otherwise, people are not necessarily keen to talk to other people anyway. So if I can get online and get what I need to get, and I'm very sure of what I'm getting, and AI is making sure that I'm getting the right answers, I'm quite happy with it. I don't need to talk to any pesky telemarketing.
Right. Pesky humans. Yeah.
So some of that is going to happen for sure. So I think AI is going to play a big role in everything, and including sort of providing this kind of support for small businesses. And every small business is going to deploy their own AI to become more productive and all of that. So there's going to be a set of people who are going to get supercharged, become kind of more productive because they have figured out how to use AI. So that transition is going to happen. And there are going to be some people who just don't figure it out. And then they will complain that, hey, I didn't know that I was going to get. But, you know, the other related thing, which is very strange, and I'm not a philosopher, but this is a very interesting question. The reality is that governments, and I can see this in India, because of the fact that, you know, people are going to get improved productivity and everything else, GST and taxes, government is going to have more and more money.
Yeah.
And the easiest thing for governments in a democracy to do is to distribute the money. I see basic universal income happening. Everyone will be given some form of
stipend or
some form of money is getting distributed. Already, apparently, 800 million people get free rations from the government.
Yeah.
So they'll not be on the street. They'll get that 10,000 rupees that I was saying. They'll find a way to government to give away 10,000. So, okay, fine. You're not going to starve.
Sure. But at least establish the floor.
Yeah, is that floor might get established. Yeah. But that said, so what will people do? That's a good question. And that's what I worry about. That's what I worry about. So at least I believe that, you know, some level of circular economy. So if you have games going on, people giving massage to each other and all, pay each other. Yeah. We keep each other busy because of the trade and economics. We'll have things to do which are more meaningful. We'll create meaning out of all of these things, and the food and thing is taken care of, but we still have things to do. And then you build the cream on top of it as to whatever. So I think it's going to be an interesting next 10 years, but I'm not really thinking too much along what might happen. I'm saying, hey, irrespective of whatever happens, you know, you need to figure out how to survive this, and to survive, you need to learn all the time. So going back to where we started.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with Anand Deshpande. Stay tuned. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Krish Ashok, author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tim France. Hey, this is Samir Gadia.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with Anand Deshpande.
I'm thinking about the, again, when it comes back to some of these nano entrepreneurs and the real kind of working engine of the economy, not just the floor of those folks, but the people who are going to be receiving this kind of mentorship. And with all the elevators and the accelerators, whether through DASRA or the Second Orbit or I4C or aggregating local better data for cancer genomics, how can you personalize your expertise and story, not just to motivate the individuals who you meet with, but actually for an entire population? You know, Daniel Pink is, talks about autonomy and mastery and a larger purpose as being these driver principles for individuals. So how does that translate to building this huge network of nano entrepreneurs who feel like they're part of something bigger than just themselves?
I don't know if I've gotten that level yet. I think the reality is that many of these nano entrepreneurs, and it's a very strange community, they are not necessarily that open to sharing what they're doing. But when they get stuck, yeah, they need help. And that's when they come to us. So I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. I think there's information that's available. I'll take it. And that's it. So at this moment, we don't have a real community. I do count who's done what. And we have a sense of who's coming to our website, what are they picking from the digital platform. And I can see anecdotally that it makes a difference. We would love to build a community, but I think this may be harder to do. I think I have a better chance at the Second Orbit community where, it's a smaller number of people and they have a different level of maturity in terms of how that might go. But personally, my thought process at the moment is to see that, at least at this time, I believe that I have the necessary skills to convince people at large to sort of look at big problems. I'm using, personal finance to some extent or philanthropy to some extent to sort of take risks on some of these problems. So I don't mind going wrong in a way, meaning if I made certain things and it didn't go anywhere, I would have lost some money. But it's my money. I'm not dependent on anybody else kind of feeling bad about it. And I realize that I'm in this to make experiments and make things happen. But I'd like to see the difference at a larger canvas rather than help one company or mentor two people and all that. So I could do that. But I, at least at this moment, I think, the problems that I can see from where I'm sitting in India and the fact that I have access to a set of community of people, friends who are there and all that. And I can hear the buzz around and the gaps as well. So I feel I can make a... I feel, I'm in a situation where I can make impact at a broader level. And people, I've been trying to talk to more and more people in my category and community friends to say, why don't we look at big problems rather than looking at the ones in my immediate vicinity? So it's been good, actually. I've been enjoying this fact. So I'm trying to say, okay, if I do something, how do I see broader impact?
Yeah. We had talked previously about threats and how similar or different they are. And we touched a little bit on pride, especially as an Indian entrepreneur, and both at the small scale, at the Second Orbit scale, and at the, kind of more macro scale. How do you think Indian entrepreneurs can find identity in the coming years? With all the factors, what do you think this looks like, both in leading and in collaborating?
I think in India, he has slipped a lot in the last 10 years, last 5 years, I would say. Even I think people are very proud of, I think sometimes not always substantiated, but people have too much confidence about their abilities and what can happen. I worry about the arrogant side more than confidence side at the moment. If you look around and the number of people who are trying to do startups, this, that, and all, it's just a little crazy. Everybody thinks that they're going to be the next, whatever you want to call them, but we have now enough.
The hot startup.
That we have enough, quote unquote. Everyone, if you listen to all the guys talking about startups, they'll call out the numbers of startups as 65,000. We had 650,000 we incorporated in the last 6 months or 1 year. Yeah. Some ridiculously large numbers. And we have the third largest number of unicorns and all this other stuff. So, you know, there's a whole bunch of buzz around all of this stuff. I do believe that we need to be more reasonable. All these businesses that are around, we're not going to succeed. This is the way of life. We don't understand how to handle failure too well. So all those issues are issues we'll see in a few years' time. If these businesses don't succeed, what happens to them? And we don't have an environment to make many of these businesses succeed. So that's where I'm spending a lot more time, is saying that, you know what, many things have to align, and that may be a little bit of luck and various other things to happen. But by doing some basic things, right, you can ensure that your cash flows are always positive and you have more money that you earn than you spend, right? So that is not, that is mechanics, okay? That's straight engineering and straight physics, and there's no complexity in that. And this can be managed and you can figure it out whether you want to make money or not, right? So, so I'm mainly focused on making sure that, you know, businesses at different level understand what they should measure so that they are making money. And if they make money on an ongoing basis, they feel confident that they can make more money out of it. And money is just a, it's just a measure. It's one of the measures. Okay, it can be, say, no, I don't care about money. I see impact, whatever it is. Point is, you should be able to measure what you're doing and keep getting better at it. And the basics of this don't change. And I think this is something that small businesses can do. And if they do that, they will be better. If they're better, that's a good thing. Rather than necessarily saying, are they going to be spectacularly successful? I don't know that answer. I don't want to even go there. I don't know. I'm not promising anyone any of those kinds of things. But
by the way, is that important for the Indian entrepreneur to be have that tempered confidence and not be overconfident or brash? And do you think that that is a risk, you know, particularly in 2024, in defining the identity of the Indian entrepreneur?
I think there is a long way to go. So yes, but I think at the moment, if you look at the ones who are in it, they do feel like that. But I think we still have a long way to go. There is, so again, I'm not talking about the top end or the middle end who may be really crazily confident and all. I'm working with a lot of very, very small businesses who are struggling. So in my universe, that's not the biggest problem that I worry about. I think what I'm trying to help businesses is to say, hey, there is a process, there is discipline, there is well understood ways of how you do things. I'm not inventing this. You don't have to invent this. These are well-known things. Right. Just use common sense. Learn some of these things that are there, how to manage cash flows, how to manage your businesses, expenses, what should you measure? How do you hire people? How do you, you know, how do you focus on your product? How do you take your product to customers? There are some standard things that the world has figured out. You may not know them, but then you can learn them. So go figure these things out, and I can help you figure them out. And if you do these basic things, you'll be better off than you are today. That's the basic focus that I'm focused on. And I think I want to do this at scale. So I want to do this for a million businesses and 10 million businesses. And everyone should feel like, you know, I have a chance. I can go out on my own, make things happen, and I will make, you know, I'll do better every incremental way, and I'll see more and more returns. And depending on where I want to be, I can peg in, or, you know, all these factors, right? How much money do you put in? What returns you get? What level are you operating? But if you know what you're doing and you're doing it knowingly, then that is fine. I'm not suggesting every company needs to be a unicorn.
All the things that you mentioned so far come with both a great sense of timing and the ability to take calculated risks, and a good sense of, as you mentioned, discipline and gravitas, and being open-minded, but also being very focused. Mm-hmm. I'm imagining that at this stage of your career, and with all the different interests and activities in your portfolio, both personally and professionally, that the word legacy must come to mind at some point. So I'm curious, for you, how do you think about legacy? And I'll frame it in this way, that when new people who may not actually have ever met you before, when you meet with them for the first time, how do you hope that they feel after having met?
So again, I don't think too much about legacy, but I do feel like, you know, I am, for many people in the community that I hang out with, I am seen as a guy on the street who in the last 30 years started with nothing, basically a professional degree, and learned it their way through a business. And I've reached a stage where, you know, I have now relatively well-known position. People kind of see the visibility of the business and all that stuff. So I see this as a way for me to be an inspiration for the local community in some sense, that if somebody like me could make it, they could also make it. And that to me is quite good in the sense that it gives people the confidence that, hey, you know, I'm inspired that this is something doable, because a lot of the other role models that we have in the community are sort of alien in some sense. You know, everybody feels, oh, you know, they're second generation. My grandfather should have been doing something.
Right.
So this is like, you know, me and my stuff. I'm a professionally qualified guy, and I can make my own story happen. That's, I think, very compelling and powerful for many of the young people that I meet. And I like the fact that they can feel good about it. Beyond that, you know, I'm not thinking too far.
Yeah. Well, being relatable, making sure that people are inspired by not only the work you have done and the work that you're leading, but all of the change and innovations that you're bringing to a larger community. Anand, thank you so much for joining us. This was really quite a treat, and I hope we can visit with you again down the road.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd love to meet you. And thanks a lot.
Thanks so much again, Anand. And a big thanks to you for rating and reviewing and passing the word along to your friends and family about Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Please again, be fiercely conscious of our climate and the planet, and try to deliver a random act of kindness along the way. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.